So again, starting on slide number 2, I'm Ted Lanzano, and I'm a Brownfields project manager. And then after I speak, Dan Heffernan will present as well. So it's a very full agenda today, and I'm going to begin by providing some general information on Brownfields and the types and amounts of Brownfields grants. Then I'll pass it over to Dan for more of technical discussion on the competitive grant process, and he'll go through the threshold criteria, ranking criteria, and then I'll finish off with some useful application tips and some additional resources. So moving to slide 4, in the Brownfields program, what we try to avoid is that we start with a dirt field and a chain link fence, and then after the cleanup, we end up with a dirt field and a chain link fence. So even the site may be clean afterwards, the community often doesn't perceive a lot of benefits in this process. So the whole point of the Brownfields group program is that you not only clean up the site, but you turn it into something productive for the community, and that way your before and after pictures don't look the same. So on slide 5, to that end, our program is designed to help communities get through hurdles and work together to assess, clean, and reuse Brownfields property. And we have financial and technical support for environmental assessments, cleanups, and also job training. So what exactly is a brownfield? Many organizations have their own definition. EPA's is real property, the expansion, redevelopment, or reuse of which may be complicated by the presence or potential presence of hazardous substances. And again, to get EPA funding, your project needs to meet this definition. So basically, there has to be a reuse potential, and there has to be actual or perceived contamination. So according to that...
Slide 7.
And then moving to slide 7, so according to that definition, what exactly counts as contamination? After the Brownfields Law in 2002, we now have a very broad definition that encompasses many different contaminants. It's not just limited to a list of hazardous substances. Rather, you can use your Brownfields Fund to address contamination from a number of sources, from old gas stations, from scrap yards, mine scarred lands, contamination associated with controlled substances, lead-based paint, asbestos, just to name a few. We really try to be very open with this. So by cleaning up and then moving to slide 8, sorry, I forgot to be mentioning the slide number. So by cleaning up their sites, there are numerous benefits that our communities have realized across Region 8 and, you know, and all across the nation, increasing local tax base, facilitating new job growth, taking development pressure off of undeveloped land, and preventing sprawl, among many other benefits that are listed there. So moving to slide 9, on a national level, the impact of the Brownfields program has been really tremendous. For a $595 million investment in a little more than 10 years, we've been able to assess almost 12,000 properties, leverage more than $11 billion in cleanup and redevelopment funding, and generate almost 50,000 jobs. So we're certainly very proud of that, and we hope to continue this trend in the future. So,
slide 10.
And then slide 10. Thanks, Dan. So now I'm going to talk a little bit about the different grants that we have. And here's just an impressive before and after picture of a mine site cleanup in Crested Butte, Colorado. And even though we talk a lot about the economic benefits associated with brownfields, another reuse that we encourage is just environmental preservation and for recreation. And that was the goal of the Crested Butte project here. And moving to slide 11, here's just a quick look at our overall budget on a national level for brownfields. Approximately 70 to 75 million goes towards our different grant programs, which include assessment grants, revolving loan fund grants, direct cleanup, job training, and our brownfields targeted assessment. And then the purpose of today's talk is to show you how you can access part of that $70 to $75 million for your communities. We also give $50 million to our states and tribes. Congress set aside this to fund their brownfields core program, and we work in partnership with states and tribes to implement our brownfields work. And then moving to slide 12. So of all the grant programs today that I mentioned earlier, today we're going to be talking about assessment, revolving loan fund, and cleanup. And we have many names for this trio of grants. We call them ARC, our 104K grants, competitive brownfields grants, and we are now no longer using the word pilots associated with these. We phased those out a number of years ago. So just a little tutorial there on some of the terminology. Moving to slide 13, and you could probably know that our brownfields grants are very competitive, and it really does take time and effort in constructing an award-winning proposal. So we really encourage you to be prepared to put in time and effort into constructing a winning proposal. And moving to slide 14, so just how competitive are they? Well, nationally, last year, about a third of the grants got funded. In Region 8, we received 16 proposals, and we had 5 new awards. So, however, while it may be competitive, Region 8 is underrepresented nationally. And because of their now national efforts to have greater distribution of grants across the nation, yes, it is competitive, but we see that as an advantage here in Region 8. And I think it'll be refreshing for a lot of the reviewers to see new communities out there applying for grants instead of just some of the more standard ones that we see more commonly in Regions 1 and 5 and in other areas that receive a greater portion of the grants. So moving to slide 15, here's information about the application timeline. The ARC, again, that's Assessment, Revolving Loan Fund, and Cleanup, the request for proposals will be out within a couple weeks. Hopefully next week, could be even the week after. And then after which you will have 90 days to apply. Because we've made so many changes to our guidelines, we thought it would be fair to allow folks an extra 30 days to prepare their proposals. And also you should know that new for this year that we'll have 3 separate requests for proposals. In the years past, we grouped assessment, cleanup, and revolving loan funds all into one packet, and now those will be separate. So if you're not interested in a cleanup grant, you won't be distracted by going having to go through those pages. And we have made considerable changes to the guidelines, and that really is the thrust of this presentation, is to go over a lot of what those changes are. So moving to slide 16, this shows 2 links where you'll be able to see those new guidelines. One is at our EPA Brownfield website, which is listed there on slide 16, and then also at grants.gov. And also just to note that this training really is not a substitute for paying attention very closely to the detailed guidelines. And then we will, of course, be talking about those, but, of course, you need to read them very thoroughly. So, okay, so moving to slide 17, I want to talk about the 3 grant programs for today, assessments, cleanup, and revolving loan fund. First, starting with the assessment grant program. You can use assessment grants for a number of different purposes. Inventory brownfield sites, characterize, conduct phase 1 or phase 2 site assessments, assist with community involvement efforts, just to name a few. And one of the great things about the assessment grant is that there is no match requirement. They can be for community-wide, where you do a number of assessments across a community, or they can be site-specific, and coalitions can also apply. But starting off with community-wide here, up to $200,000 for hazardous substance and up to $200,000 for petroleum. And last year, the guidelines required separate applications for hazardous substance and petroleum, and now this year you can submit one proposal for $400,000 for both hazardous substances and a petroleum assessment. So we certainly like to reduce redundancy, and I think that's one of the ways we've done so. So moving to slide 18, you can also, under the assessment grant program, you can also apply just for a single site. And while these are not as common, they're certainly allowed, and you can apply for $200,000 or up to $350,000 with a waiver. And site eligibility and ownership eligibility is part of the threshold requirement, and Dan will be getting into that a little bit more. So moving to slide 19, new for this year, something we're all very excited about, is that coalitions can now apply for up to $1 million for assessment grants. It has to consist of three or more eligible entities, and you must conduct a minimum of five site assessments. And then these coalition members are not eligible to apply for individual community-wide or site-specific grants in the year that they apply as the coalition, but the year after they would be. And we really see that this is a great opportunity for communities to work together. You know, we see potential projects as contiguous counties here in Colorado applying for grants to assess mine-scarred lands across large areas in a watershed, for example, or contiguous counties can apply to assess gas stations along a particular interstate, just to name a few examples. But we certainly hope to receive a few applications from assessment coalitions. Moving to slide 20, this is just a quick success story. This is in Ouray, Colorado, which is in southern Colorado, and they were able to assess 231 mine claims over approximately 2,200 acres and then transfer many of those claims over to public ownership. So we certainly, again, we hope to see more projects like this in the future. Moving to slide 21, another grant program that we'll be talking today is our Revolving Loan Fund program. And basically what this is it's a grant to an eligible entity who then uses those funds to make low interest or no interest loans to developers and site owners for cleanup activities. So in essence, the grantee is acting like a banker and providing cleanup loans. The grantee can also use part of these funds just to make sub-grants. And we've seen a lot of success with this, with the Revolving Loan Fund, or RLF, here in Colorado with the coalition. And a cost share is required of 20%, and for this one, nonprofit organizations are not eligible to apply. So moving to slide 22, this is a success story. We've got the City of Aurora here in Denver. They have a Revolving Loan Fund grant, and they were able to use a loan of about $500,000 to a developer to clean up an old open dump there in the city. And you can see on the right, the site's now clean, and it will soon be slated for affordable housing. And also there's a park there. And also the Colorado Brownfields Foundation and the state of Colorado were involved in the park cleanup as well. So moving to slide 23, the last grant program that I'm going to talk about is the cleanup grant program. And here is $200,000. To carry out cleanup activities at brownfield sites. It could be for hazardous substance or petroleum contamination, and you can apply for up to three properties, but separate proposals for each one are needed. And let's see, nonprofits may apply. There is a cost share of 20%, and community notification is now a threshold criteria. Last year it was part of the ranking. And Dan will be getting to that into greater detail. An important factor here that I don't have on the slide is that a Phase 2 assessment is required prior to the application and prior to the award, not at the time of application, but prior to the award, you have to have ownership of the site. So those are some important considerations to have thought about before you apply. And moving to slide 24, this is a success story of a cleanup grant in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. It involved the cleanup of an old scrap yard and allowed for the connection of the commercial district to the riverfront. And this is really an impressive project where they were able to leverage millions of dollars with the help of the EPA cleanup grant. Moving to slide 25, we do have other types of brownfields funding and technical assistance. These are not for not the purpose of today's call, but we do have our job training grant program, which is grants to colleges and nonprofits to provide environmental skills trainings to communities affected by brownfields. And there's a picture up there in the upper right of the Turtle Mountain Tribe and their job training program. And we also have targeted brownfield assessment funds available for communities, which is it's not a grant. It is where we use our own EPA contractual support to do a phase one, phase two for a community. And you can apply for those at any time. So, and then with that, I'm going to pass it over to Dan, who's now going to talk about the, just going to give an overview of the ARCA threshold criteria and go from there. So.
Thank you, Ted. Like Ted said, I am Dan Heffernan. I'm the brownfields coordinator here in EPA Region 8, which covers Colorado, Montana, Utah, Wyoming, South, and North Dakota. And we also work with 27 tribal nations here in the central part of the U.S. our team is here to help you out. If you've got questions, always feel free to give us a call or email us. There's contact information at the end of the presentation here. But if you're new to brownfields or you have a question or have come across something that you haven't thought of in the past, please feel free to contact us, and we'd love to help you out. Also, please be sending in your questions via the website as we go. I just saw one that came in. We do have legal counsel here from EPA who's here to help figure out answers to these questions. Ted and I also will scratch our heads and try to help you out here. We'll leave sufficient time at the end for folks to verbally ask some questions. But please do interact with us. This isn't an ideal format for having a grant writing workshop. But we can reach all the corners of our region this way, and so it works out as long as people are willing to either take their phone off mute later or send in questions now, and then we'll get an interaction going. What I'm going to do is take some time now to go through the questions that are asked in our request for proposals for our assessment, our cleanup, and our revolving loan fund grants, and basically explain what the different sections are. There's two primary groupings. One are the threshold questions, and these are basically the pass-fail questions. And then there's a ranking section, and these are the questions where you're judged by how good your answers are, how thoroughly you answer all the questions in the section. I'm going to go through each of those two sections and then give it back to Ted, and he's going to go over some just general grant writing principles. So with that, if you would advance on to slide number 27. As I said, there are these threshold criteria for each of our grant types. These are primarily legally based requirements that come right out of the Brownfields Law of 2002. Basically, to ensure that you're eligible to apply for the type of grant that you're applying for, and then to ensure that you're likely to be successful if you do receive that grant. These are pass-fail, as I mentioned prior. You've got to pass them all. If there are any questions, once we receive the proposal, we'll contact you and try to sort it out. Our goal is to make you eligible, but then again, these are legal requirements, and so if you're not eligible, don't waste your time applying for it. So, slide number 28. This is a laundry list of the various threshold questions. We're going to go through this one by one, trying not to spend too much time, but still trying to get the detail of them. Please note that not all of the threshold questions apply to all three of the grant types we're discussing: assessment, cleanup, and revolving loan fund. as you'll see on each of these bullets, there are some parens that indicate which grant types it applies to. If it says ARC, that means all three, assessment, revolving loan, funding, cleanup. If it says RLF only or RLF and cleanup only, that means if you're applying for an assessment grant, you won't be answering to this threshold question. You won't even see this question. So those are going to be denoted at the top of each slide, which grant type it's for. Sorry if there's any confusion based on that, but we're moving from having all three of these grant types in one request for proposals to where we're now splitting it out into three, and we'd like to be able to discuss all three of them here for folks who have different interests. So sorry if there's any confusion. Let us know if something isn't clear, and we'll try to clarify. The next slide, 29. This is going to begin with who's eligible to apply, and this is actually fairly simple, and it comes right out of the Brownfields Amendment of 2002, the Brownfields Law. Basically, our grants are only available to governments, tribes, local governments, states, and quasi-governmental organizations. If you're not a government, you generally cannot apply for our grant, for these three grant types, unless you're a 501c3 nonprofit, and that's a specific tax code, 501c3 nonprofit. They are eligible for cleanup grants and cleanup grants only, not for assessment or for revolving loan funds. Slide number 30. We've had revolving loan fund coalitions in the past. As Ted mentioned, we now have assessment coalitions that we have created as eligible applicants for assessment grants as well. Of note here, if you want to apply as an assessment coalition, and we'll talk more about this later on, but it requires at least three eligible applicants to come together as a coalition. For a revolving loan fund, it only requires two eligible applicants to come together as a coalition. You can have more than that, and that's likely to strengthen your proposal from a ranking standpoint, but we'll discuss that during the ranking portion of this. The other thing on these coalitions is that both types, for revolving loan fund or for assessment projects, they do require letters from all coalition members be attached to your proposal for funding. Slide number 31. This is a pretty simple slide. If you're applying for a cleanup grant, you do not have to have ownership of the property that you're applying to clean up when you apply. However, you do have to take ownership, and it's called fee simple title, but it's basically you need to have title to the property by June 30th, 2009. So you can apply for a grant for a project to clean it up, and once you know that you've received funding next spring, then you can go forward with actually purchasing or accepting the property if it's being donated or however it's going to work. We'll talk more about acquiring properties and some due diligence, some of your prior steps that you're going to want to take later on. But just know that June 30th, 2009 will be the deadline for taking ownership. If you do not acquire the property by June 30th, 2009, you forfeit the grant. If you're selected to receive a cleanup grant, you forfeit it, and it goes to someone else who has ownership. So slide number 32. This is a letter from the state or tribal environmental authority. This is generally from the state authority in which you are applying for a grant. If you're a tribal government, you're generally the tribal environmental authority who is applying, and you do not need a letter from yourself to apply. If you are within a state and you are applying for a grant, you need to let your state Department of Environmental Quality or Department of Health or whatever it is for your state, your environmental department, know that you're applying, and you should do that early. You should do this yesterday, if not today or tomorrow, and get their feedback, get their input, get their buy-in. This letter requirement here should be the very last step. You should have already gotten them to review the proposal, to add input, perhaps to add some dollars, especially once we start talking about cost-share requirements. If you can get your state to chip in on your project, that's going to make it rank better, and it's going to make you have a greater chance for success. But the main goal here is we do not want you writing a proposal, and then a week before you submit it to EPA, you send it to the state and say, can we have a letter of recommendation from the State Department of Environmental Health? make sure that you've gotten that way in advance, and they're just basically giving you a letter saying, yep, we've been a partner in this for the last 3 months. So moving on to slide number 33. Now we're going to talk for the next several slides about site-specific ownership eligibility issues and liability issues. As we are talking about environmental contamination here, it's very important that we discuss liability. That said, we can't go into too great a detail here because that is a many-hour seminar in and of itself. What we're going to do is touch on the basics here and then hopefully lead you to go ask some more questions and to be careful before you take ownership of contaminated sites and make sure you do your due diligence prior. On this slide, you'll see CERCLA Section 107 liability as the first bullet. You can skip to the second bullet, and this is basically Superfund liability. And what you really need to know about this, if you're kind of new to environmental contamination, is this is an incredibly broad authority and a very all-encompassing liability provision, which means if you're going to take ownership of a contaminated site, you want to be very careful. With that said, there are ways to take ownership, and that's what we're going to discuss here. Slide number 34. There are certain sites that are not eligible for brownfields grants. This slide lists what those sites are. The first bullet, national priority list sites, those are Superfund sites, the Love Canals of the world, if you will. The second are properties that are under an order to do something about their contamination. And then the third are properties that belong to the federal government or under the jurisdiction of the federal government. You cannot apply for an assessment grant to assess Forest Service land, U.S. Forest Service land. Belongs to the federal government. You cannot use grant funds to assess that. These are statutory prohibitions from the Brownfields Law. They cannot be included. Slide number 35. We're going to start here. There are two specific types of sites that can be dealt with Brownfields money. The first are hazardous waste or contaminated sites, non-petroleum. EPA is the decision maker on these to decide whether or not the site can be addressed with grant funds. The main thing here is that the applicant cannot be liable under CERCLA, under the Superfund law. And again, we're going to be talking about that for the next several slides. That acronym CERCLA is misspelled here. But the second type of potential brownfield site is a petroleum site, former gas stations, other sites that are potentially contaminated by petroleum products. In every case other than tribal, the state within which the site resides is the decision maker whether or not the site is eligible for brownfields funds. Request your state's determination early on. This will be another determination made by the state via a letter that says, yes, this site is eligible, and then it will need to be attached to the proposal. Without getting into too many details, this has to do with other federal and state laws and other pots of money that can be used to address petroleum contaminated sites as well. Making sure we're not using multiple pots of money to address the exact same site is the primary issue. Moving on to slide number 36. We're going to now move into ownership eligibility issues. This is for site-specific grants, assessment and cleanup, where you know the site that you want to work on, and you're applying for a specific property with a specific address. again, the main point here is that there are ways to acquire properties that are contaminated without taking on liability. And with that, we'll advance to slide 37 to discuss some of those ways. Basically, there are two ways to go about this. The first is involuntary acquisition. That's the first red call out there. And then the second is voluntary acquisition of a site. The first one's fairly simple. Involuntary acquisition, this would be for a government generally, via tax foreclosure or eminent domain. The property falls into delinquency on their tax, property tax, and the local government takes ownership of the property, doesn't have any choice, and therefore you're not liable for the contamination on that property. You can apply for a grant to assess or clean it up. The second is voluntary acquisition. This is where it gets quite a bit more complicated, and I'd really stress that folks should do their homework, talk to legal counsel if you have it available to you, and again, just do your research prior to actually voluntarily acquiring a piece of property. This can mean purchasing a property, taking it via donation. The primary means of taking hold of contaminated property without taking on liability are to be one of those three defenses to the Superfund law: a bona fide prospective purchaser, an innocent landowner, or a contiguous property owner. The bona fide prospective purchaser is the one that's underlined there because that is the one that most often is applied. That's the one that generally is the one that folks that are going to acquire a property, that's one they fall under as far as a defense goes. Slide number 38. So we're going to focus on the bona fide prospective purchaser, BFPP, defense to Superfund. And here are the criteria for it. You can't be responsible for contamination on the site. Can't be affiliated with anybody who's responsible for it, business, familial, etc. The January 11th, 2002, ignore that bullet. That's just, that has to do with actual liability defenses in the event that there's contribution claims or something like that. For grant purposes, it doesn't matter when you acquired it. You can acquire it tomorrow or you could acquire it 10 years ago. And you may be able to apply the bona fide prospective purchaser defense. There are other continuing obligations that are required for this. This has to do with once you take ownership of a contaminated site, what do you do with it? Fencing, signage, capping, allowing access to state and federal agents, things of that nature. So there are obligations to go along with maintaining this defense if you're going to try and assert it. All appropriate inquiry there, then, is the final four bullets are in reference to it. You have to perform all appropriate inquiry prior to voluntarily acquiring a contaminated site. And that's basically a phase one assessment. It's called due diligence. This is the book report, basically, on a property. It's generally fairly inexpensive. Generally, lenders require this if you're going to be doing any kind of vertical build on a property. You're going to generally be required to do a phase one assessment, and there are thousands of firms out there that do these. They're fairly inexpensive, all things considered. They generally do not require any sampling to be done, or anything as invasive as that. So, you have to do that prior to acquisition, and they do have a shelf life, a phase one assessment does. Basically, within 6 months of it being completed, it must be updated for it still to be viable for a bona fide prospective purchaser defense. So I hope your heads aren't spinning from all of that, but this is something that if you're going to be acquiring a property voluntarily, you're going to need to do some research on. And it can be done, and it is done quite often, and you can be highly successful at this, and we're here to help you as well navigating all of this. Slide 39. Slide 39 references various assessment standards for doing a phase one assessment depending on when a property is acquired. We're not going to go through these. This is just to say different standards came online at different periods in time, and if you acquired a property prior to a standard, there's generally a standard that preceded it that you would be using or be required to have met for all appropriate inquiry for one of these liability defenses: bona fide prospective purchaser, contiguous property owner, or innocent landowner defense. If you acquired a property voluntarily prior to May 31st, 1997, basically before there was a standard for doing all appropriate inquiry, the final four bullets discuss what would have been your due diligence at the time. And this gets fairly complicated. I would encourage you to contact EPA, contact your state, and work with your attorneys to determine if you have some way of documenting some due diligence prior to acquisition, that you went out and did a visual inspection, that that there was some kind of record search that was done, things of that nature, that should have indicated contamination or likely contamination on the site. The next slide is slide 40. This applies only to cleanup grant applicants, so if you're interested in an assessment or revolving loan fund, give your ears and eyes a break for a second. Cleanup applicants for this year are required to have a Phase 1 compliant, all appropriate inquiry, Phase 1 completed prior to applying. That's always been a requirement. The second thing is you also now have to have a Phase 2 assessment completed. And there's the ASTM standard is listed there for doing a Phase 2 environmental site assessment. This is the more invasive site assessment. This is where you might take soil samples, groundwater samples, surface water samples, things of that nature to try and determine the contaminants on site and the extent of that contamination. That's going to be required that's completed prior to applying for a cleanup grant now. And this is basically to ensure, because we do have, this is such a competitive grant program, that we're awarding grants to cleanup applicants who are ready to go out and actually clean it up. They know the extent of their contamination and they're ready to clean it up. Slide 41. For site-specific assessment and cleanup applications, petroleum sites only, you've got to provide answers regarding the petroleum threshold questions to your state agency as we discussed prior. Get in contact with them early. They're going to need information about your site, and they're going to be making a determination whether or not it's eligible for brownfields funding. And those last bullets there discuss the requirements that they're going to be looking at, that it's a relatively low risk, and that's a determination by the state. There's no viable responsible party, that you, the applicant, are not responsible for the contamination, and that there are no Resource Conservation and Recovery Act corrective action orders on the site at the moment. So again, get in contact with your state early. They will need to make that determination prior to you even applying. Moving on to slide 42. Cleanup oversight. These are for cleanup and revolving loan fund applicants only. The first bullet there, indicate whether or not you plan to enroll in a state or tribal voluntary response program to oversee your cleanup. The second bullet there, indicate if access might be an issue, how you will gain access to adjacent and neighboring properties for the site that you are addressing, if you have access agreements or can get them, or if you, the applicant, own those adjacent properties, that's valuable information. And then the third bullet there, the legal opinion. This is for revolving loan fund only. In previous years, we've required multiple legal opinions based on a discussion of the jurisdictional boundaries for your entity and then also on your ability to capitalize and then recapture loans that are made. Now we're going to allow that to be one legal opinion, that all rolled up into one. Again, this is trying to streamline things, get rid of some of the redundancy. It's generally the same attorney that's giving both opinions, so now they can just give one legal opinion. But this basically shows that as you can see from the starred section there at the bottom of this slide, 42, this basically says that if you're going to be the coalition applicant for a revolving loan fund, if you're going to have a coalition of multiple cities, towns, tribes, et cetera, acquiring for a revolving loan fund, you've got to show that you've got jurisdictional authority to access secure sites for all the coalition members. And you've also got to show that you've got the ability to capitalize and then recapture loans and subgrants for all the jurisdiction of all of the coalition members. So you've got to show a broader jurisdiction than just your own town boundaries, for example, if you're also working with the neighboring town as well. So, moving on to slide 43. There, as Ted said before, there is no cost share requirement for our assessment grants. And that's a really positive thing about our grant programs. There is a cost share required for our cleanup and revolving loan fund funding. It's a 20% cost share on each. The kickers are that the 20% that you use to match our funds cannot be federal dollars, but they can come from private sources, local government, state government, etc. Those are all fine. It doesn't have to be a dollar, a fiscal cost share. It can be in the form of in-kind services, labor, etc. So you're just needing to show the dollar value then for that 20% cost share. Those, if it is a non-dollar, or even if it is a dollar-for-dollar cost share, you need to be able to show that those are allowable and eligible expenses, meaning that if you were applying in this grant application, you could apply to use the grant dollars to pay for those activities. They can't be for ineligible activities or, you know, activities that are totally unrelated to your project. The third bullet there, their hardship waiver can be requested if your entity has a specific hardship financially and cannot cover that cost share. You can request a hardship waiver. There are instructions in the request for proposals in the guidelines as to how to do that, and it's generally a narrative discussion of what the circumstances are that make it so that you cannot pay that 20% cost share. And then the final bullet there, if it's a revolving loan fund, that cost share requirement can be passed on to the borrower. So if you are a city and you are capitalizing revolving loan fund to give loans to developers to clean up contaminated sites, you can just put that cost share requirement straight through onto the loan to the borrowers. So it doesn't necessarily have to come out of the city's coffers in that example. Slide number 44, community notification. This has changed a bit. The agency, EPA, is moving this around, it seems like, every year, how we deal with community notification. And what we're trying to do is get valuable community notification and at the right time and about information the communities are concerned about. How it stands this year is that this is a threshold issue, and it's only for cleanup grant applications. So if you're applying for a revolving loan fund, or you're applying for a community-wide assessment grant, you don't need to do community notification at the time of application. What you'll need to do is once you have sites selected, then you'll do the community notification process as part of your public outreach. But the basics of this are you need to provide the public with notice that you plan to apply for this grant for a specific property. You need to place an ad in a local paper that covers your target area. You need to clearly communicate that there's a copy of the grant proposal with all the specifics available some in a certain location for people to view it. There are some examples there, town hall, libraries, posting it on the city's website, the tribe's website, etc. Advancing to slide 45. You need to indicate that you will accept comments on that proposal, on the draft proposal for funding to EPA. And you need to indicate the date and time of a public meeting where you will accept comments. If you are submitting applications for multiple grants, if you're going to submit an application for an assessment grant and one for a revolving loan fund, we have a note here that you can have one meeting to cover all of them as long as they have the same, you know, the same targeted community. You can cover all the different applications with one meeting there. And something else to note here is, and this count, this goes for everything, we do have extensive frequently asked questions that we post each year for our guidelines. And there are, like I said, extensive frequently asked questions and answers on the community notification piece. These will be posted on our website and will be referred to in the guidelines when they do go final in the next week or two. So I encourage people to go through those, query those, query them by question, and that'll bring you to the answer to that question. So, slide number 46. For RLF applicants, you need to, this is getting back to that jurisdictional issue that I mentioned prior, you need to have a discussion of the jurisdictional boundaries of the applicant. So you need to say the city limits, the state limits, the what have you, these are our boundaries, and that's what the area where the revolving loan fund will capitalize loans, for example. advancing to slide 47, that's it on threshold issues. I'm sure it felt like, wow, there's a lot of prerequisites for even applying for these grants. I just wanted to go through it in some detail for folks. If you have additional questions, please do send those in. We will answer them for you. The guidelines will be going final in the next few months, and like we said before, they're going to be specific for each of the three grant types, and so there shouldn't be all this discussion of revolving loan funds if you're really interested in a cleanup grant. Now we're going to discuss the ranking criteria. This is where we actually have a panel of reviewers at EPA who reviews and scores your application on these following criteria. This is now based on the fact that your application has passed through the threshold section and you are being ranked to determine whether or not your proposal scores high enough to be selected for funding. We'll advance. There's just an example of a cleanup project here on this slide, just a little bit of eye candy for folks. This is another MindsGuard Lands project in Colorado that we're pretty proud of. Slide number 48, where you see that new call out there, our ranking criteria section has been overhauled this year from what it's been, what it's looked like the last couple of years. We used to have many more sections to this. It was not very linear, and we got a number of comments from folks, and we had a number of internal comments that we needed to revise these. So we did. And this is how we'll be discussing it for the next half hour or so, is based on these four criteria. And we think it's fairly linear. And just kind of as an overview, criteria number one, community need. Tell us about your community. Tell us about your brownfield issues. Criteria number two, project description and feasibility of success. Tell us what you plan to do and why it will be a successful project using our grant dollars. Number three is community engagement and partnership. Tell us how the community will be involved in this, will have a say throughout your process, and then who your partners are in this that are going to ensure success. And then section number four are the project benefits. Tell us when this is all done, what the great benefits, economically, socially, environmentally, what are those benefits going to be? And now we're going to go through all four of these sections one by one. But what we're shooting for here is to make this fairly linear so that you're telling a story from the beginning to the end in this ranking section so it's as clear as possible. Moving on to slide number 49. This is just some specifics on our ranking criteria. They are made up of sub-criteria. Answer each one individually. Sub-criteria may be the same or different per ranking ranking criteria per grant type. The sub-criteria for revolving loan funds don't all exist in the assessment application. So make sure that you're applying for the right grant type and don't think that they're transferable answers. The total points are out of 100 for all three grant types. So we've gone with an academic type of scale here to try to make this as clear to folks as possible. But the various sections and then the sub-criterias within them have varying weights to them between the three different grant types. And those are posted in the request for proposals and the guidelines that you'll write to. It tells you what the point weights are per section. And again, it's out of 100, so just think of it as a percentage, and you're going to really want to devote as much time and effort as possible to the sections that have the highest point values to them. Moving on to slide number 50, we'll jump into the community needs section. This is where you're talking about your community, specific health issues in your community, specific welfare, monetary issues, environmental issues. This is where you're going to talk about your financial needs in the targeted community. And again, it's a targeted area, and we'll hit on this a few times. If you are a state or you're a large city, or even if you're a county that's got a large land area, if you're targeting a specific part, a specific corridor, a specific district, et cetera, you need to discuss that district, that corridor, their health and environmental issues, their economic challenges throughout your proposal. Don't go drifting into some other area that isn't going to be addressed by these grant funds. Then you're going to see call-outs here at the bottom of a number of these slides that basically say, if you use any statistics or you use any studies to discuss any of this, you know, you're using data from a census, for example, you need to cite where you got that, which census, et cetera. So moving on to slide 51. This is just in a bit greater detail, health, welfare, and environment. You need to discuss the number and size of brownfields in your area. What types of brownfields are you dealing with? Do you have a lot of abandoned gas stations? Are there old factory warehouses, things like that? Discuss what they are. Discuss how they relate to the surrounding community. Environmentally, economically, how they impact them socially, etc. So we've got here, discuss the type, the number, and the location of your brownfields. Discuss what the typical contaminants are. Discuss if there are any sensitive populations in the area, elderly, children, etc. And discuss if there's any disproportionate environmental impacts in the area. If there have been any cancer cluster studies, for example, if you have inordinately high rates of asthma in the area and you have brownfield sites that are potentially having an air quality impact, to the extent you can tie those together, that's going to be beneficial because, again, this is a ranking section where there's a numeric value that's created by reviewers. Again, identify all of your sources as you're going. If there has been a study done, if you're using any kind of census data or such, make sure you're identifying where it comes from. Slide 52, this has to do with financial need impacts, the economic impacts of brownfields on the targeted area, targeted community. This is where you're going to want to discuss poverty rates, household incomes, unemployment rates, things that show a disproportionately impacted area, high unemployment rates, low income rates, things of that nature. provide examples, and then here's some call-out bullets here. Use current and relevant data. Use the most recent data available if possible. Use a table format so that it's easy and understandable for reviewers to understand what you're talking about to the extent that you're using data. And then compare it to a state or a national data. Make a comparison. Tell us why these, you know, the economic impacts are especially negative on this area. Compare it to, give us some kind of a comparison. There's also the, discuss the impacts of brownfields economically. You know, if you had a factory in town and it's shut down and now you've got 2,000 unemployed workers, that's a disproportionate economic impact based on now a brownfield site likely. And then also discuss why other financial resources aren't available to assess the brownfield. So we've got some examples there, the financial conditions, the city doesn't have the money to pay for it, things like that, or the population size of the area might be a reason why. Moving on to slide number 53. Project description of feasibility success. This is the second section of the ranking criteria. This is where you're going to tell us exactly what you propose to do and how it's likely to be successful. This is where you want to discuss a reasonable approach for your project, that you have sufficient resources to complete your project, and that you have the capacity, the ability to complete your project. There are some call-outs here of just some things to note. If you budget the majority of your funding for actual assessment work, and this goes also for cleanup and revolving loan fund, if the majority of the money is budgeted for actual site work, that's a positive, generally speaking, in reviewers' eyes, as opposed to budgeting it for, you know, lots and lots of meetings or, you know, just getting aerial photography of sites or things like that. So, if you have an assessment coalition, if you go for the $1 million assessment coalition route this year, note that you've got to assess at least 5 sites with that $1 million. And then you can refer to the Brownfield programmatic requirements to read EPA's expectations of projects funded with Brownfield assessment grants. Moving on to slide 54. This is again for all of the assessment grant, assessment revolving loan fund and cleanup grants. You've got to describe the project that you propose to fund. For cleanup proposals, you also must propose what your cleanup plan would be, because remember, you're required now to have your phase two done. So you've characterized your site, you know what contaminants they are, and what the extent of the contamination is by this point. And you should have a good idea of what the cleanup would need to be in order to get to your reuse or redevelopment goals. So, and then you should be able to discuss if there are any institutional or engineering controls that are going to need to be in place. Will there be deed restrictions on the property when you get done with it that say that you can't drill drinking wells, for example? Even if those aren't hard and fast yet, you want to discuss if there's a likelihood that, you know, there's going to be a drinking, or there's going to be a well prohibition that doesn't allow for wells to be sunk, or something like that, that are likely to be in place. And then what your reuse plan is. And again, to the extent that you've had community input on this, and you've got community buy-in for your reuse plan, it's going to be to your benefit here, competitively speaking. 55, for revolving loan fund applicants only, what is your redevelopment programs? What's your plan for the RLF grant fund? How will your revolving loan fund be sustainable? How is it going to revolve over time? Who are your expected borrowers and sub-grantees? Is it private sector? Is it governments? Who do you figure is going to be borrowing from you or requesting sub-grants to do cleanups? What's your marketing plan? How are you going to let people know that this fund is available and what it can address and answer questions that folks may have about taking a revolving loan fund loan out? And then what's your overall plan for success? Who's committed to this? Who's going to be involved in this? What kind of experience and expertise do they have? Things like that. So that's for revolving loan fund only. Slide 56 is for all 3 grant types, and we're going to get into the budgets here in a little bit more detail for each grant type. But basically, for your budget section, you're going to have a table formatted budget, which we provide in the guidelines. Stick to our table. Don't go with your own budget table that you use somewhere else. You're also going to need to have a narrative section that explains the different costs, what the different tasks are, and the related costs. Make sure you know about cost eligibility. We have something called an administrative cost ban in here, and there's a section in the appendix of the guidelines that discusses what prohibited administrative costs are. And it's fairly clear there. Make sure you read through that. Don't include those administrative costs. Don't include the word administrative costs or administrative in there in your budget section. Ask questions. Ask us. Ask state DEQ folks to help you out with your budget. And then The equipment cost, there in the budget, it discusses what equipment is. Generally speaking, these grants are not used to purchase equipment based on the federal government definition of equipment. And you'll see this in the budget section. There'll be an italicized area that discusses what equipment is. Generally speaking, there's supply costs, contractual costs, personnel, fringe benefit, personnel, travel, and other costs, generally not equipment. Moving on to slide 57. This is the assessment grant budget that is included in the guidelines. Just wanted to give you a visual of what we're looking for. Along the left column there are the various categories. The budget categories, personnel, fringe benefit, travel, equipment, supplies, contractual. There on the bottom, you'll see the footnotes of explaining some travel costs that we anticipate you having if you get our grant, what equipment is and what it isn't, and then what a little bit about the contractual component as well, and some of the requirements for it. Running across the top row, you'll see the task numbers there. That's where for an assessment grant, you'll say, task one is going to be inventorying sites. Task two is phase one assessments. Task three is community involvement. Task four is phase two assessments. And then you're going to have the associated costs for each of those that you're anticipating. Moving on to slide 58. This is the cleanup grant budget. Very much the same as the assessment grant budget, with the addition of the cost share row there at the bottom of the table. On top of everything that we just said for your grant portion, you also need to include the 20% cost share and where that's going to come out of there on that bottom row. So it needs to add up to 20% of the total amount that you're requesting. So if the grant is a $200,000 request, you need to have $40,000 worth of cost share here among the various tasks in that table format. Slide 59 and 60 are both almost identical to slide 58, these are the revolving loan fund budgets. The difference is that for revolving loan fund applications, you need to submit two budget forms to us, or two budget tables to us. One is for loans that will be made, and the other is for subgrants that will be made. So include both budget tables in your application along with narrative discussing both of them. I'm going to have you advance to slide 61, so you may be skipping two slides here. And I promise we're getting there. We're getting through these slides. I know it's a lot of slides, folks. Hopefully you're hanging in there with us, and you're getting the information you need. And if not, make sure you're asking the questions, and we'll address it. This is the leveraging section for all three grant types. This is where there's going to be work that's not covered by your assessment grant or by your grant funds. What are your other funding resources that are going to be applied to the project or could be applied to fill in any funding gaps that you might have during the assessment, the cleanup planning, the actual cleanup, or the reuse phases? So what can this money leverage, basically, is what we're wanting to hear. You can see there we've got in red, describe all of your possible gap funding sources. And this can be private dollars, this can be local government dollars, this can be federal dollars, this can be whatever is going to be put towards this project, whether it be HUD money or state money or foundation money, etc. So the more you can show here, the better. And then finally, you're going to provide examples of past leveraging for similar projects. So try to make sure that it's rather similar in nature for any projects where you were able to get community development block grant money or something like that to go towards your project. So slide 62, this is the programmatic capability piece, slide 62 and slide 63. This is where you basically tell us that you're able to do this project. And you answer it a bit differently if you've ever gotten an EPA Brownfields grant versus if you've never gotten an EPA Brownfields grant. The first slide, which is 62, assumes that you have gotten a Brownfields grant. So this is an either, you answer one or the other. You don't answer the questions for both here. If you have gotten an EPA Brownfields grant in the past, you're going to want to tell us about your grant management and your performance. You know, did you expend your funds? Did you comply with all the federal requirements of them? Did you accomplish what the goals of the grant were, et cetera? You're going to tell us if there were, have been any adverse audit findings against your organization, and then if there's any, been any correction for any of those adverse findings that have ever been found. Slide 63, these are the questions you're going to answer if you've never gotten an EPA Brownfields grant. You may have gotten grant funding from all over the place, but not from EPA Brownfields program. And therefore, you're going to tell us what your plan for managing the grant will be, what your expertise is regarding things like acquisition, or if you don't have in-house expertise for managing the grant, how you're going to acquire that expertise. And then you're going to give us your prior three-year grant management history, basically. Federal, state, foundation. If you've gotten grants from Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, for example, tell us that you've gotten it. Tell us what it was for. Tell us, you know, that you're in compliance, assuming you are, you're in compliance with any reporting requirements and such with it. If there have been any adverse audit findings, let us know that. And then if there have been any corrective action for any of those, let us know that as well. Slide 64. Community engagement and partnership. This is a big one with EPA. Let us know what your plan is for engaging the targeted community. I've already hit on that a little bit. I'll just say it one more time here. This is another place where you're going to want to discuss this. We've tried to reduce redundancy throughout these guidelines so that you're only saying things once. But if we ask the question in two different sections, answer it in both places. Tell us how you're going to engage the targeted community throughout your project, getting community input, letting them know well in advance what the plans are and allowing them to impact those plans. Who are your partners? That's bullet number two here. Identify who your partners are in this project, what the relationship is, and then what their role is vis-a-vis your project. And then the third one, we're going to be evaluating based on the extent to which your support letters provided by community-based organizations demonstrate valuable commitments to the project. So I'm going to talk more about that here in a second, but just know that don't just have people write you letters of recommendation or don't mention them in your application unless there's a marriage of the two. We want you to mention what the role is of partners and then also have them write a letter of recommendation that is identifying that they're going to fulfill that role. 65, community engagement. This is for all three grant types. Describe how you're going to engage the community in your site selection, cleanup planning, site reuse planning. To the extent that you've already done, say, site selection, explain what the community's involvement was in that process. Were there public meetings? Were there, you know, public picnics that were held? Things like that. Did you give notice prior to making decisions in the past? Those are all things that you're going to be ranked on for community engagement. What is your plan for reporting progress of the grant to your community throughout? Are you going to have quarterly meetings? Where are they going to be? How is it going to best address your targeted community? Address any language barriers. This is one that people generally trip up on. If English is the primary language of your targeted area, it's fine to state that. You want to also state that should other languages, you know, communities in the targeted area be identified who English is not their first language, that you're going to translate materials or have meetings or things of that nature that are going to make sure that they know what the planning process is and how they can impact it. And then the final one there is just basically a best practice. Make sure that you have a good plan for involving your public. Make sure that it's thorough. Make sure that it's clear to EPA that you are not doing your project in a vacuum, that your public has impact, has an involvement in it. Slide 66. This has to do with your partnerships with health and environmental agencies. This is the state health or state environmental agency, as well as likely county health, Indian Health Service perhaps, different agencies that are tasked with, you know, providing for the health of the population. What's your plan for partnering with them? How have you partnered in the past with these organizations? If you're going through a state voluntary cleanup program, for example, you're going to want to discuss that you have knowledge of that program. You know how it works. Perhaps you've already applied to enter into the program, things of that nature. Slide 67. This has to do with community-based organizations, and this is another one where we've got a fairly extensive frequently asked question on our website that is referenced in the request for proposals. If you're going to mention that there's a community-based organization that's got some involvement with your project, and we recommend that you do, you need to discuss what their role will be in the project, and then you need to have a letter from them that describes it. Community-based organizations can be civic organizations. They can be faith-based organizations. They're fairly broad. They're basically just not government officials. It's not your state senator. It's not a community-based organization. The mayor is not a community-based organization. The Boys and Girls Club is a community-based organization. So we try to be very broad with this, and we allow people to let us know how they're going to have an impact on the project, and we view it as a very big positive to the extent that they can be involved. So I would recommend people look at that frequently asked question and then get creative. It doesn't matter if it's a large community or it's a very rural, small community. You've got community-based organizations, and they can play a role in these projects, and they definitely will make your proposal more, the likelihood of success for your proposal is going to go up. So the next slide, 68. Now we're finally to the final ranking section of this. You're almost done hearing my voice. So this is the project benefit section, and it's just that. You're going to tell us what the benefits of this project are. How does it promote general welfare through the improvement of public health, safety, the economy, the environment of the targeted community? This is also where you're going to discuss where your project fits into a larger vision, whether that be perhaps a 20-year plan for your area, perhaps your climate change plan for your area. You may have some kind of a planning document or a blueprint for your community that this could fit within. And to the extent that you can connect your project to a larger effort like that, that would be wonderful. A growth plan, for example. slide 69, staying on this project benefit section. The welfare and public health, you're going to discuss what the potential exposures and risks in the area are, and then how they're going to be reduced. Let me kind of retract that. Hopefully what you've done is, in the project description part, at the very beginning, you've discussed what some of those health and environmental concerns for the area are. Here you're going to discuss how your project is going to address those and reduce them, hopefully. You're going to look for, we're going to be looking for things like discussion of exposure pathways that are going to be reduced, risk and blight reduction here, and then what's your your plan for community and sensitive population protection throughout your project. If you've got a cleanup project and there's going to be asbestos that's going to be removed, this is where you talk about part of your community notification and community outreach is letting the community know what they can do to protect themselves, when to stay indoors, things of that nature, and then what your steps will be to minimize any adverse impacts. So, slide number 70, these are the economic benefits and or green space benefits. Brownfields is kind of interesting in that we have some kind of dueling goals here. Some are for economic redevelopment outcomes for our projects, and then we also have goals for green redevelopment or green reuses, parks and open space and such. They're both good things as far as we're concerned. Your project can have an end of one or both of these things. So describe what your economic benefits are going to be, if there are going to be any. Increase in jobs, increase in tax base, etc. What the projections are. If we clean up this site and a new building goes on top of it, what are the projections for that? if we're talking about, and then the second piece of that is describe what the non-economic benefits are. If there's going to be a park that's created, if there's going to be stormwater retention that's going to be improved based on the project, things of that nature. The reviewers, like I said, think that both things are good, economic redevelopment and then nonprofit reuses. Your project may have both, it may have one or the other. Discuss them as best you can. Slide 71, and this is my last slide, and Ted's going to have a few more and then we'll open it up for discussion. what are the environmental benefits for infrastructure reuse and sustainable reuse is what this sub-criteria is all about. To what extent will the redevelopment or the reuse of that is the end goal of your project, is it going to reuse the water and sewer lines? Will it result in the reuse of roads instead of sprawl out into previously undeveloped areas, things of that nature? And then also the sustainable reuse of sites. If you're going to have development on a site, are you going to require or have they already volunteered to do LEED certification on a building? Leadership in environmental and energy design, I believe, is LEED. So that's got to do with green building and energy efficiency. When there's building renovations, are they going to use green materials for those renovations? Things of that nature. And then also green cleanups. If it's going to be a revolving loan fund or a cleanup grant and there's going to be cleanup done, we've got a whole lot of literature on how that can be done in an environmentally sensitive way, how alternative fuels can be used, how idle reduction can be used on heavy equipment, things of that nature, that will then limit the amount of air pollution and the such. So these are all things that can be built in and are going to get you more points in the final analysis of your application. And with that, I'm going to take a breath. I'm going to turn it over to Ted. He's going to hit a few slides, and we'll take questions.
All right. Thanks, Dan. Hi, everybody. This is Ted again, and I'm going to talk now. I'm on slide 72 about some useful application tips. Some of these might seem obvious, but it seems like year after year, proposals could certainly be improved if they address some of these tips that I'll go over. So hopefully they'll be helpful to everyone. on 72, I just have a few images there of a cleanup that we're currently doing right now in Creed, Colorado, of some mine site, of some mine tailings, and they're going to be building a new Mineral County Fairgrounds Association there. So again, it's another cleanup that we are proud of here in Colorado, and hopefully more of these can happen across Region 8 and elsewhere. So moving to slide 73, I'm going to go through some of these proposal prep tips. And first of all, of course, read the new guidelines and follow directions. As Dan mentioned, has gone through, these are significant. These have significantly changed, and it's important to read all of the details there. And to help with that process, I think it's important to get mentoring from prior or current grantees on their proposals. And if you need assistance on locating grantees in your area or grantees who have similar projects or similar sized communities, or perhaps are dealing with similar types of contamination, we here at our program can help you get in contact with those communities, or we do have our site where you can search communities in your area. And on the third bullet, write as though the reader knows nothing about your community. If you're in Region 8 and you submit your grant proposal, the reviewers will not be from Region 8. They will be from any other region in the country. They could be from Atlanta. They could be from Boston. And they will know, you know, assume they know nothing about your community and explain it as thoroughly as possible. So that's just an important factor there. And then also on the fourth one, address all the criteria. Don't just leave it blank. If it doesn't apply to you, say so and explain why. Sometimes we have applicants that say, oh, well, that didn't apply to me, so I didn't feel it was necessary to talk about it. Well, the reviewers aren't going to understand that, and they will take off points for that. So please just explain why it doesn't apply. And then new for this year, we have the proposal checklist, which will hopefully help folks at the end of their proposal, make sure they have all the required letters and pieces in their proposal, because you don't want to have to go back and have to submit something later that you might have missed. And then lastly, avoid using acronyms and some technical jargon of your organization. Again, this gets back to assuming that your reader knows nothing about your community. We have made some efforts in our new proposal guidelines to limit the legalese and the technical language to make it more readable and understandable, and hopefully you will reciprocate that and not use some of the jargon from your organizations. let's see, on page, we're now going to slide 74. Let's see. Very important, we have an 18-page limit on the proposals, and when these all get submitted, anything beyond 18 pages, not including the attachments, but as far as the primary ranking criteria, anything beyond 18 pages will go to the recycle bin. So please limit everything to 18 pages. And then also, don't bother with any color or maps or photos or anything like that. We Xerox or we copy the proposals multiple times, and chances are, and well, we don't do them in color, and chances are some of the maps and photos are going to get distorted. And so if you reference something in the text to a map, could be that we won't even be able to understand it. So try to avoid any kind of maps, photos, or color in your proposal guide, in your proposals. All right, so on to slide 75. And Dan touched on this, and we encourage folks to get in touch with your state, tribe, or EPA very early. Don't wait until the last minute, the last week before the proposals are due, and say, hey, I need a letter of support from you. We encourage you to work with the state throughout the process. During the application period in a few weeks, EPA will be somewhat limited on what we'll be able to say and not say, and the state and your tribe will be able to speak more freely and have more experience on that. So we really encourage you to work closely with them. And same goes for your the partners with whom you'll be working on your project. Don't just have the lead applicant do it in a vacuum. Work with the partners and get their input, because the more you can reflect that in your proposal, the stronger it will be. And same goes for setting up public meetings and getting public input. It's really important that your proposal reflects the input of the public, and even more importantly, reflects the input of the community in need that you talked about in the very beginning of your proposal. So to the extent that it can reflect that input, the better it'll be. And again, if you're going to be applying for a petroleum a grant to address petroleum, you'll need to get in touch with your state to get the low risk determination, which Dan talked about earlier. So going to slide 76, this is a picture I took of Dan a couple weeks ago, up in Crested Butte. No, just kidding. This is a picture of an old miner near Crested Butte. So, but I'm going to talk about some resources, and then we'll go into some questions. So, moving to slide 77, this is our Region 8 Brownfields team. You can call any one of us, and all of our contact information is on our website. You've got Dan's phone number up there at the top. Feel free to call us at any time, and again, we'd love to work with you on these projects and help in any way we can. Again, we've mentioned to work with your states, and here are the lead contacts for each of our six states on slide 78 and on slide 79. In looking at the phone number for the Dan Shepherds of the state, Colorado, I think we have the wrong phone number there. I don't know it offhand, but I can get that for you if you'd like. So just the state contacts are there. Again, we encourage you to get in touch with them. And on slide 80, we have some web-based resources linked there. Again, the proposal guidelines will be out either next week or the following, we really hope. And they'll be at the EPA website there listed or at www.grants.gov. We're also going to have a very extensive frequently asked questions document, which we think will be really helpful. So it's there. The link is there. And then as well as some fact sheets on the changes of the guidelines, which is already up on our website. And then also a fact sheet on the Brownfield Assessment Coalitions, which we talked about is new for this year. So moving to slide 81, let's see. We keep our Region 8 Brownfields website up to date with current information, so we really encourage you to be checking it out periodically to see what's new. We'll also post all the proposal guidelines there. And then another website which has some great technical resources is SmartE. I was just there the other day to look at a financial tool. And just a great website that can help you with your proposals and technical questions you have with brownfields cleanup and redevelopment. So with that, slide 82 is the last one of the day. And we would love to open it up for questions. We have a few here already that have been submitted electronically. So why don't we get started with those first, and then we can just open up the phone lines and folks can take their phones off of mute and ask us some questions. But why don't we start out with some of the first questions here?
Yeah, we'll get it rolling here, and then we'll open it up. I'll throw one out here, and then maybe somebody can chime in online or over the phone with the next question. This one's out of Helena, Montana, and the question is, for cleanup grants, is there a waiver so folks can apply for up to $350,000, similar to the assessment grant waiver? The answer to that is no, unfortunately. The Brownfields law stipulates that cleanup grants can be for no more than $200,000, where in contrast to assessment grants, where the Brownfields law mentions the $200,000 and then this waiver language up to $350,000 per site is included in the Brownfields law. So $200,000 is the cap on a cleanup grant application per site. You can apply for multiple sites, though. Thanks for the question. Let us know if we don't answer them as we go. Anyone want to jump in with another question? Hearing silence, we will go to another question out of Montana. This one's out of Missoula. Regarding slide 54, second to the last bullet, this is a slide that is in regard to what are called institutional controls. If there are institutional controls remaining after cleanup is completed, is this viewed as a negative with EPA. So if a site is not cleaned up to a pristine level where it can be unrestricted use, and this may be kind of technical jargon for folks who aren't real familiar with this, but if after the cleanup the plan is to leave some contamination in place and then limit your use of it so that you can't, say, build houses on it, but you could put commercial development on it, is that seen as a negative by EPA? And the answer is no, not necessarily. What EPA is really concerned with is, reviewers are very concerned with ensuring that you understand that end use and what kind of controls would need to be in place. But if a community says to us, we need commercial space or light industrial space or whatever, and so that's the standard that we're cleaning up to, and here are the institutional controls, the deed restrictions, et cetera, that we'll put on the property and ensure that nobody ever builds houses on it, then from my experience as an EPA reviewer sitting on a number of these panels, that is not seen as a negative just because you didn't get to unrestricted use for a site. Any questions people want to chime in with over the phone? Well, here's one I think that probably our attorney can best chime in on. It has to do with, the question is, may an applicant use ARC grant funds to pay a consultant who engaged for the grant application process? So I would guess this is who had some impact on writing the grant application or something. And I'll turn it over to Dave Schachterly here for some input.
Well, I'm going to assume that fits into the administrative cost prohibition. It wouldn't matter whether it's through a consultant or direct employees of the grant recipient, that those would not be allowable costs. The problem with the consultant is going to be when you go to procurement. That's a second part of the problem, and that is when there's a consultant that comes on board and helps you with your grant application, of course they're going to want to do the work as well. And you're going to have problems when you do procurement, especially if you are thinking, are you going to let the consultant engage in the procurement process? You know, let's go to that first question.
Okay.
And that is the coalition. The first question concerns, it happens to be in Michigan, which I don't think is part of Region 8, at least it didn't used to be. Upper Peninsula might be. But it had to do with, under Michigan law, there's different things that are created at the county level, and whether each of those things would be able to join a coalition. The more coalition partners you get, the more ability you have to get more grant funds. The issue on that, I think, is there's two elements to it. One is what region you're in, and the second, what the state law requires or allows for lower tier governments. In Region 8, and we'll take the example here, there's one land bank authority that's created by the or that's a state entity that's created at the county level, and then there's the county. And would each of those qualify as a separate coalition member? That depends on state law. If their state existence is based on different state statutes, if they're not, like the county health department and the county lands department, where they're subunits of county government, they might qualify as two different coalition members. Up until a few months ago, I would have answered no, that they're not, they don't qualify. But I found that some regions are looking at different state agencies as different entities. So it probably depends on what the regional view is, because I don't think there's a national consistency on that issue.
So yeah, this question is out of Michigan. A person in Lansing, Michigan, you're in EPA Region 5, which is our Chicago office. And so I recommend that you get in contact with them. They'll have better idea of the different authorities under Michigan law. But the broader coalition question is good for everybody on the phone for both assessment and the cleanup applications. Their initial question is, can a coalition consist of a county and two or more municipalities within that county? And generally speaking, yes, that could be coalition members. You could have any kind of combination of cities, counties, states, tribes, and then, you know, redevelopment authorities, quasi-governmental redevelopment authorities, assuming that they meet some criteria like Dave is talking about, which will vary from state to state. But it doesn't matter if they have nested jurisdictions. And in fact, for the revolving loan fund, the recipient of the grant, the coalition recipient of the grant, has to have jurisdictional authority over all of the coalition members' areas. So you're looking at a state or maybe a county or a redevelopment authority that can do work in all of the applicants' jurisdictions. So that's a good question. We appreciate that and encourage you to contact EPA Region 5 in Chicago. Anyone want to chime in with questions over the phone? We don't bite, we promise. Here's a question out of Casper, Wyoming. Is there a size requirement for a petroleum site to be eligible? And the answer to that is no. We have no kind of size requirements one way or another. Brownfields are sometimes an eighth of an acre, and sometimes they're hundreds of acres in size. The eligibility issue will come on, is that site being dealt with under another authority? And then is are the liability issues such that, whoever the potential grant applicant would be is eligible for funding for that site? But no, generally speaking, the size of the property does not affect any kind of eligibility. Another question out of Wyoming. Let me get to it here. Oh, thanks. Could railroad land contaminated by a freight house and fuel farm qualify for a grant? What consideration do I need to keep in mind? The city owns the land, but only with a quick claim deed. Again, this is Wyoming. This is a great question, and this is the exact kind of starting point where people need to be at. If you've got some ideas of some likely brownfields in your area that you're interested in dealing with, how do I start researching this? And in the state of Wyoming, I would contact the Wyoming DEQ right away. They have brownfields experts there. One by the name of Vicki Meredith. Her contact information is on slide, probably 78 or 79, something like that. And what you're going to want to find out is what the current regulatory issues are with that property that you're talking about. Are there any orders against it? Who's investigating it? Likely, oftentimes, nobody is. Likely, you know, it's basically it's free of all that regulatory red tape and entanglement. But the state's probably the best place to start with those kind of questions when you're doing your research. And then as far as the ownership goes, there's a difference, and I'm not an attorney, real estate attorney, quick claim deeds versus fee simple title. I believe there's a distinction there. For EPA purposes, we're concerned with fee simple title of a property, and whether or not you've done your due diligence prior to that, if you've done your phase one assessment prior to taking fee simple title. But I would caution folks to move slowly and make sure that you've done your background research prior to actually taking ownership of the site, which is, for our purposes, fee simple title.
But again, this is Dave Schachterly. A quick claim deed would be sufficient title. It gives you, as long as it gives you full title to the property. In some instances, all you can get is a quit claim, especially like with mountain mining claims, all you're going to get is a quit claim deed. The other possibilities in some instances may be a long-term lease. It depends on the nature of the interest that's transferred is what you'd have to look at. And also what's the reason you have a quit claim versus a fee simple. Those would be factors you have to keep in mind.
Okay, so it gets fairly complicated on specific sites sometimes. And like I said, probably your first person to go to would be your state Department of Environmental Quality or Department of Health, and they'll help you navigate both the legal issues and also trying to figure out if there are any regulatory hurdles and what the likely contamination is. We're always willing to people coming in over the phone with questions. We're just reading here, sorry. Give us a second. People are sending in questions.
While we're looking at some of the questions, I also wanted to add that we really encourage folks to fill out the online evaluation form, which can be accessed just at the very end of this presentation. So we really appreciate all of your feedback, and we look at it seriously. So thanks in advance for filling that out.
Here's a great question from someone down in Naples, Florida. So glad you all could call in, and you guys are EPA Region 4, which is out of Atlanta. I encourage you to contact them. The question is, I'm led to believe that for a community-wide assessment grant, funds may be spent for Phase 1 without proving that the current property owner is not the responsible party. Is this true? And then it says, what about Phase 2 assessments? Assessment grants are to governments only, so let's use a scenario. A city receives an assessment grant from EPA, wants to go out and do assessments on some privately held pieces of property. The city does not own these properties, and the city never did. That's going to be our example here. The city may go out there regardless of if there are potentially responsible parties or not. It doesn't matter who the owner is. If the city wants to go out and do the assessment using our grant funds, that's in large part where Brownfields got its start, was local governments using our grant funds to go assess private properties, determine if they are contaminated, or dispel myths about potential contamination so that they could get put back into productive use, get cleaned up and put back into productive use. So that's a great question. The answer is yes, grant funds can be used on properties where there's a potentially responsible party. They just cannot be used to benefit the responsible party. So if the city gets a grant from us and wants to go assess the city's bus fleet maintenance facility, that's not going to be an allowable use of the funds because the city's liable for that, and you can't use our grant funds to address something you're liable for. So that's a great question. Boy, there's some long questions coming in. Anyone want to chime in? There's one here on tribal issues and what the requirements are of our grant programs regarding tribes. This is from an individual in Alaska. I would refer you to the EPA's Seattle office because these issues vary from place to place, and we can speak to tribal eligibility for grants within EPA Region 8, but we'd be going way beyond our expertise if we spoke to it in Alaska. And so our folks in Seattle are more than willing to help you out with this, and so I would refer you on to them. And if you need contact information for anybody, any of these regions, please feel free to contact me, and I'll put you in contact with an individual, not a website.
There's a question about consultation. Concerning whether a downtown development authority or an economic authority would be considered a community-based organization. Again, it would depend on how they're created and what their purpose is and who belongs. So if they're created under statute, if you have an economic development authority created under statute, that wouldn't qualify as a community-based organization. But if you had a downtown, like if there's a downtown ship, if it's a coalition of business owners in the downtown area, and that's really all you have in the downtown area because there aren't really any residents, then we'd have to look at the specifics of the situation and see whether or not they would qualify as a community-based organization.
Yeah, and again, I'd recommend people look at the frequently asked questions on the website that will be referenced in the request for proposals, because there is a section on community-based organizations. And this is an area where they can have a financial impact, they can have a direct impact on the proposed scope of work, they can have a role in a number of different ways, and they can be very broad. But as Dave just said, if they are a government or a quasi-government or an elected official, generally this is not where they should be addressed. Those folks should be addressed as other partners throughout the proposal, but not as the community-based organizations per se. Does somebody have a question? I'm hearing somebody off mute. Wow, here's kind of a complicated one out of Florida. I'll try to take a stab at this. Don't quote me. Don't think that this is the definitive answer. It says, with regard to contacting the state if applying for petroleum funding, I want to apply for an assessment grant as part of a coalition. Most of the sites in the area are abandoned gas stations. However, another coalition member has hazardous materials. What exactly do I need to get in the letter from my Department of Environmental Protection? Does the requirement exist for both site-specific and coalition applicants? The answer is no. You need that letter, the petroleum determination, if you have a specific petroleum site that you are applying to address. So if you want a cleanup grant or a site-specific assessment grant to address a specific petroleum contaminated site, you need a letter from the State Department of Environmental Quality making a determination that that site is eligible for brownfields funding. If, on the other hand, which is the case in this question, you're looking at, say, an assessment coalition where you will address petroleum, you'll apply and you will state in your application that you're going to be looking at petroleum sites with this, but you don't necessarily have them picked yet. And if you are successful in being funded and you get the grant, once you have sites picked that you want to do site-specific assessment work, phase ones, phase two assessments on, at that point you will then work with your state to determine if they're eligible or not. So that's a distinction there. It's a distinction in time, whether you're going to need to contact your state right now for petroleum determination or if you'll do it later once you have the funding. Then keep in mind, regardless, if you are applying for a grant, assessment, revolving loan fund, or cleanup, whatever kind of grant you're applying for, you do need a letter of recommendation from your state that says they saw your application and acknowledge that you're applying for a grant from EPA. So that's not necessarily, that's a different requirement with of state involvement. So thanks for the question, Naples, Florida. Any other questions? Here's a general question out of Denver, Colorado that asks for what are the general positive directions that we see with the revisions that we've made to our grant guidelines for these three grant types we're talking about. What are some of the positives that we see with this? What we were shooting for was to make the grants more applicable and accessible to smaller communities, to communities that don't necessarily have professional grant writers, things of that nature. Understanding that it's fairly complex issues, that it's a difficult application to write. What we tried to do was, like Ted has said, tried to take out some of the legal jargon, tried to reduce areas where we asked the same question five times, just in different sections. So those were some of the things we were shooting for. One other thing to call out here is, at the beginning of the proposal guidelines, there's going to be a section now that discusses some of the some of the goals of the Brownfields program, of EPA's Brownfields program, and some of those goals are going to include discussion of geographic distribution of grant funds, and that that's a goal, is to get the money geographically distributed more evenly, if possible. Another goal is to get grant funds to tribal governments. Another goal is to get grant funds to specific types of sites. Mine-scarred lands and methamphetamine labs are both called out in the guidelines as guiding principles that EPA is using in our selection of projects. It is a competitive selection process. It's based on a numeric score, but recognize that these things are all overall general goals of the grant program. So there's a number of things like that that are called out now and highlighted that I think are positive improvements. So thanks for the question. Other questions? Well, I've got one more that was sent in, and I'm going to see if I can answer it for them, but I'm having to do a little bit of research here for a second. Has to do with slide 43 on cost shares for cleanup and revolving loan funds. Okay. The question is, on slide 43, under cleanup cost share and revolving loan fund cost shares, the third bullet in there, it says you have to explain what your plan is for the generating the match, coming up with the match cost share required. And we have a bullet here that says, do not exceed the required amount. That's just a general FYI to folks that it may behoove you to explain all of your additional funds that you're going to put towards the project, but this is probably not the best place to put it. In the cost share section, include only the amount of money that you want to be on the hook for if you get awarded. So if you apply for a $200,000 cleanup grant and you say that your, for example, your city government is going to include $40,000 in cost share dollars, only put the $40,000 there. If you include more there, you will encumber your city to include that in your final award document. So when you get the money from EPA, you're going to be expected to put the extra dollars beyond the $40,000 towards this project. So that's what this is cautioning you when it says do not exceed the required amount for the cost share. That's us telling you this is not the place to show all of your leveraging and all of the other resources you have to put forward towards your project. This is where you're putting down real dollar figures. And so if you know for sure you've got $100,000 to put towards this project, you can put it here, but just know that you're going to be on the hook to provide that $100,000. You can then, in the leveraging section, after the actual, you know, the budget table and budget narrative, you can then discuss all of the other funding sources, including your own general funds and such that you can put towards the project. And then you're not going to be on the hook to actually account for that later. Thank you, Coralville, Iowa. We've answered all of the questions that have been emailed in. If folks, we've got another minute or two if folks want to email any others in. Otherwise, as Ted said, please advance to the final slide of the presentation and click on the link, or on the feedback, online feedback form link. And please give us your feedback on this so that we can improve the delivery of this and subsequent seminars. Please be candid in your response to this. And if there are no further questions, one final thing. This is being, as Ted said, this is being recorded. So if you want to go back and reference any of this, you can go back to this website and go to the archive section.
And one last note, on September 15th at 1 p.m., we will be delivering this presentation again. So if you or any other folks who you know of are interested in applying for grants would like to attend, we'd love to have you. So registration information will be on our website at www.epa/region8/brownfields. So thanks so much for attending, everybody, and we'll sign off from here.
Thank you.